Our next session number is 47229, Diagnostic Testing for Thyroid and Parathyroid Disease. Once again, our speaker is Dr. Richard Nelson.
I forgot to repeat the questions. They're taping these sessions. I apologize for that, for those who have to listen to the tape afterwards. Are there any questions, those of you that were here on the last session, any questions on the adrenal before I move into the thyroid? You had your fill. Okay. Let's move into the thyroid gland. I'm trying to do a little bit better staying on time, although doesn't really matter, I guess. What I'm hoping to do is talk about, again, diagnostic evaluation of thyroid tests. Start with hypothyroidism, and then hyperthyroidism in the cat, and then, assuming I get that far, just a little bit on hyperparathyroidism in PTH. Thyroid gland function tests. That's what we're going to focus on, not a discussion of hypothyroidism per se. I know that sound. That's my son's call. tests. There's two tests. There's two groups of tests that we use in the thyroid gland in the dog. Now we're focusing on hypothyroidism. One are tests that assess thyroid gland function, and one are a group of tests that are used to identify lymphocytic thyroiditis, which is one of the two primary forms of hypothyroidism we see in the dog. The other is idiopathic atrophy that may be an end stage of lymphocytic thyroiditis. But it's a pathology test. It has nothing to do with thyroid function at all. Okay? The function tests are T4, T3, free T4, free T3, TSH, and such. All of these are potentially available, depending on what commercial laboratory that you use. To me, the primary players are T4, free T4, and TSH. This one, and this one. There were several studies from multiple sites back in the 80s. We had a couple ourselves that showed really minimal diagnostic value for T3. It's just, it doesn't come from the thyroid gland. Most of it comes from monodeiodination of T4 in peripheral tissues, then leaks back into the circulation. It's not a marker for thyroid gland function. Less than 10% of thyroid hormone secreted from the thyroid gland is T3. It doesn't work very well. I don't bother with it. We don't measure it in our hospital. Haven't measured it in a long time. If you send to Michigan State, they still give you the T3, the reverse T3, the free T3. I ignore it. Because I get those panels that come in, you know, some people will send them out to Michigan and they come up to me for a referral and I'm interpreting those numbers. I just ignore the numbers. I don't care what they are. Because I don't believe that they're of any diagnostic usefulness. Other than antibodies against T3 are more common than antibodies against T4, and you can see screwy numbers as a result of interference of the antibody to the hormone. So these I don't pay attention to. This one, and this one are the ones that I look at. And of the lymphocytic thyroiditis test, thyroglobulin is currently the in vogue one. It's the best test to identify lymphocytic thyroiditis or immune-mediated thyroiditis in the dog. The question then becomes, how do you mix that cocktail? What do you use as your initial diagnostic step? A lot of it depends on where you are. To me, you've got really three options. One option is to do a single hormone test, which, in my opinion, would be the T4, as opposed to the free T4. The free T4 is a better test. It's better because it's not affected by non-thyroidal illness as much as the T4, and it's not affected at all by antibodies in the circulation that are there because of the lymphocytic thyroiditis. So it's better in a large population of animals when you look at the two. But the downside of free T4 is it's expensive, and you got to send a sample out, whereas a T4 can be done at point of care ELISA within your hospital. So to me, a most viable option would be a single serum T4. If I was in private practice, that's what I would do. The second option is to tag in a TSH. Again, now you're talking about sending the sample into a commercial lab and seeing whether, to ask for a TSH. So you could do a T4 TSH or free T4 TSH. Gives you a little bit more information on the pituitary thyroid axis. A little bit better feel for what's going on. The ultimate is a thyroid panel. And there's all different mixes of thyroid panels that are out there. The one that I developed at our hospital and put into play about 15 years ago was a T4, a free T4 using a dialysis technique, modified equilibrium dialysis. The Nichols kit was the one we used for years. That one's kind of shaky right now, but there are others out there. The in-vogue one right now is a Diasorin two-step, which also uses an equilibrium component to measuring the free T4, TSH, and an antibody test for lymphocytic thyroiditis. And for us, we use a thyroglobulin. I think a T4, a free T4, a TSH, and a thyroglobulin, autoantibody, gives me the maximum amount of information reasonably to assess a pituitary thyroid axis. In my hospital, I just do thyroid panels. I don't do a T4 as an initial screen, mostly because it's a tertiary hospital and I'm dealing with weird cases, and it's not so easy. Most of my clients are driving anywhere from an hour to 5 hours away, and so it's like, let's just get it and do it and get an answer. Most of my clients, money's not an option or it doesn't matter, and they're crazy. So they'll do all kinds of things. So I do the thyroid panel, but if I was in a practice scenario where the client lived within a mile or two, I wouldn't hesitate to do a T4 as an initial screen. It's a stable hormone. You can transport it to labs. It's economical. It's really inexpensive to run. It's commercially available. And there are point-of-care ELISAs. The SNAP test by IDEX is, I guess, the one that's kind of the in-vogue test right now that's out there. I was at a pre-Congress meeting for North American this year where we kind of came in on an advisory board for IDEX for a couple days, and I'm not sure how much advising was done. It was more kind of an inundation of what they have. And I was actually very impressed with what you guys have access to now in terms of the types of tests that can be run in the hospital, and they can be tied into your computer systems, very similar to what we have at the VMTH. We're all computerized and paperless records and such. And it was very, very, it was very eye-opening for me. The SNAP test came out a while ago, I think 96 maybe, and when it first came out, it didn't work very well. And the first couple of studies that came out of the chute, one was out of Auburn and the other out of AMC, you know, conflicting results, didn't look like it worked very well, it was a nightmare. They kind of regrouped, brought it back out again, and just recently, in this last year, Bob Kempinen at Auburn reevaluated it again in dogs and cats. And to make a long story short, there was a really good correlation between the results of that SNAP ELISA and typical methods for measuring T4 in commercial labs, either radioimmunoassay or the Immulite test. The correlation coefficients were greater than 90% in all but one assay. Interestingly, it was the DPC assay for the dog. The only correlation there was around 65 to 70%. And within their discussion, they stated, you know, the in-house ELISA method provided reliable and consistent results. It's a good initial screening test that can be set up in your hospital, and you can run a T4, and you can get an idea of what's going on in terms of thyroid function, dog or cat. Actually, the correlation coefficients in the cat were almost between 95 and 98% with the other assays. Okay? The problem with the T4 test, and this is the issue that is the biggest issue that I see in the cases that I deal with, and it's a persistent issue. It's been there even when I graduated back in the 70s, and it continues today. This organ system, the thyroid gland, is affected by more external variables than any other endocrine system in the body. Any other endocrine system, it's just... The only effects are to drop your thyroid hormone levels. There are some things that physiologically can cause your T4 to go up, but clinically they're irrelevant. They don't matter. Anything that's clinically relevant causes your T4 to go down, and there's a big long list of possibilities. And what I put up here on the slide are the ones that I consider to be the most relevant for us in terms of practice. Sighthound breeds. Greyhounds, borzois, and such. They have a lower normal value. They're the only breeds where that's been identified, by the way. Sighthound breeds. To me, if I'm dealing with a sighthound breed, that T4 has got to be less than 0.5. And normal is, again, you've got that sliding scale, and I'll show it in a minute, but normal, I like to see it greater than 1, preferably greater than 1.5 microgram per deciliter. If you're used to SI units, just multiply it by 12. And that'll get you in the ballpark. Okay? Sighthound breeds, the normal can go down to 0.5. Those animals, you've got to have a really low result. Non-thyroidal illness, this is the biggie. Concurrent illness suppresses thyroid gland function. It doesn't mean the thyroid gland is destroyed, it just suppresses it. There's no rhyme or reason to the illness. The general rule is that the more severe the illness and the more systemic the illness, the more suppression you're going to have. You know, some mild flea bite, you know, dermatitis on the tail head isn't going to have anywhere near the same influence as a dog with congestive heart failure or a dog with hemolytic anemia and a PCV of 10 or infectious diseases or renal failure. Those are going to cause your numbers, they can go down to zero. It's a protective mechanism. So whenever you interpret T4, you have to always consider the clinical signs and the status of the animal. Do I really believe that hypothyroidism exists in this animal? And what's the severity and the nature of the concurrent illness? Especially if T4 is part of your routine panel. If your routine panel going in always gives you a T4, that's when you got to be careful. Because all of a sudden you'll be sending it in for a dog in kidney failure or something, and oh, the T4 is you know, 0.2. Well, you must be hypothyroid as well. You've got to always step back and say, why am I running, why am I looking at this T4? Is this what I was really looking for, or could this just be from a concurrent disease? Glucocorticoids and phenobarbital are the two primary drugs. Glucocorticoids will cause suppression of the pituitary thyroid axis. You can drive your T4 down to zero in a matter of days. And those steroids can be anyway, eye, ear, skin, doesn't matter. They all get absorbed. And the smaller the dog, the bigger the impact. An eye drop containing steroids has a bigger impact on a Chihuahua than a Great Dane. So the smaller the animal, my cutoff point is kind of around that 10 kilogram. You get the 10 kilogram dog or less, boy, those drops and such can really have an impact in terms of systemic absorption, suppression of not only the adrenal cortical axis, but also the pituitary thyroid axis as well. Phenobarbital is a nightmare. Phenobarbital suppresses or interferes with the production and secretion of T4 and free T4, and it has no effect on the pituitary, which means when a dog is on long-term phenobarbital therapy, your T4 goes down, your free T4 goes down, your TSH goes up because the pituitary is untouched. Glucocorticoids oftentimes will suppress the pituitary. So glucocorticoids, your T4 is low, your free T4 is low, and your TSH is normal. Phenobarbital doesn't touch the pituitary, so the pituitary responds to that drop in thyroid. And so if you've got a dog that's on phenobarbital for greater than 6 months and you do a thyroid panel, you're going to have a classic picture of a hypothyroid animal. Low T4, low free T4, high TSH. Secondary hypothyroidism in a way, drug-induced. That dog may need to be treated. Okay, you got a dog on chronic phenobarbital the rest of its life, eventually that low T4 and free T4 are going to result in clinical signs of hypothyroidism. You can't take them off the phenobarb. All you can do is compensate for the effects of that drug on the pituitary thyroid axis by putting them on T4 supplement, sodium levothyroxine supplement. Okay? Same with steroids, glucocorticoids. If you've got an immune-mediated disease or myasthenia gravis or something like that and the dog's on steroids for the rest of its life, you will ultimately develop secondary hypothyroidism induced by the drug. The clinical signs are usually subtle. Most of the time when I see them, they start to get a, you know, poor hair coat. They tend to start getting alopecia and points of wear, a lot of hyperkeratosis, dandruff and such. You know, those are indications. Hey, you know, they're on steroids. I can't take them off. We're probably going hypothyroid. Let's go ahead and initiate therapy in that scenario. These others, NSAIDs, don't really have that much of an effect. Sulfonamides do, but we don't use sulfonamides much anymore. It was a player when we used a lot of tribrisin and such, but those drugs, you know, that antibiotic's kind of gone by the wayside for all intents and purposes. Thyroid hormone antibodies are the other one, but fortunately they don't affect T4. They tend to affect T3 more, and they tend to cause the T3 to go to zero. That's where that, those of you that were around back in the late 70s and early 80s, remember we used to deal with that issue of a dog that had a normal T4 and a zero T3. Oh, it must be a conversion problem. It can't convert T4 to T3. It's got a block in the enzymes, the deiodinase enzyme, to convert to T3, so we better treat with T3. And we treat them with T3, and the T4 would go to zero, because T3 can't be converted back to T4, and a T3 supplement suppresses the pituitary thyroid axis. And we just say, oh, see, it was hypothyroid. Now the T4 is low, too. See, and now we now recognize there's some great work that Bob Kempinen did and Diane Young in Auburn back in the early 80s that documented that it was, in fact, antibody interference with the assay, giving us those T3s of zero. It wasn't a conversion defect at all. It was antibodies. But as long as we stay away from the T3 as part of our measurement and we rely on thyroglobulin autoantibody if we have to, the antibody issue doesn't really come into play. Is there a question over here somewhere? Yeah. The question was, if you have a dog on phenobarbital or steroids or anything that could suppress your pituitary thyroid axis, do you take the same therapeutic approach? And the answer is yes. Yeah. The biggest issue in terms of therapy is whether you're a once-a-day treater or a twice-a-day treater. Do you go BID or once-a-day? And that's been an issue even since I first became a veterinarian. And it's still unresolved. And the reason is that there's a wide array of metabolism of the hormone in terms of individual variability. And some animals need it twice a day and some need it once a day. And as a general rule, you don't get into trouble giving a drug twice a day if the animal needs it only once a day. In fact, you don't get into trouble giving thyroid supplement to euthyroid dogs. Most dogs that are on thyroid supplement are euthyroid. They're not hypothyroid. They're euthyroid. And thyroid hormone will give you a beneficial effect in a euthyroid dog. It's an anabolic hormone. In fact, there was a nice study that was done that looked at the effects of thyroid hormone supplementation on the hair coat and skin. And they biopsied the skin and they counted hair follicles. Sign me up for that one. And then they treated with thyroid hormone. I can't remember how long, but for, let's say, 6 months. And then they rebiopsied and they counted hair follicles. And the hair follicles, the density increased. The thyroid hormone had caused an increase in hair follicle density. Made the hair coat thicker. It's just an effect of the thyroid hormone. They were euthyroid dogs. But that's what, you know, if you use that as your marker for hypothyroidism, it gets you into trouble. Because if everybody wants to have a dog like you see in the Westminster Kennel Club dog show, you know, then you got to have thyroid hormone to get you there. Because there's a wide array of what a Maltese looks like. And I'll tell you what, as everybody here, you guys have all seen that Westminster Kennel Club, right? I love to watch that thing because I'm looking at these breeds going, is that what they're really supposed to look like? They never look that way. You know, and their hair coats flipping, just perfect. I haven't ever seen a Maltese look like they're showing that. They're fantastic dogs, but there's a wide spectrum. And if you're trying to get them look like that, you know, that's how you end up with all these animals on these thyroid supplements. And the question was, would a free T4 help you in a sighthound to ferret it out? A free T4 will always help you, whether it's a sighthound or not, because it's a little bit better test. And so what I would like to see, free T4s tend to be lower in the sighthounds as well. And so what I would want to see is both of them low. What I really want to see is both of them low and a TSH high, but that doesn't happen. The value is kind of tough right now, because we're using a diazoran two-step method, and that hasn't really been critically evaluated. We were forced into that one about 6 months ago because the Nichols was becoming just too erratic in terms of its availability to us. To me, it would still be the same, 0.5. It's just different units. So the numbers kind of parallel each other. But the normal range that's put out for diazoran right now goes down to 0.62. You know, whereas the normal range for me with the Nichols kit was 0.8. We started at 1, we kind of dropped it to 0.8, that seemed to work a little bit better. 0.62, that's getting awful low for that assay, and that's why I'm saying I'm not sure. As a general rule, though, you want your free T4 to be less than 0.5 nanograms per deciliter. Yeah. They have protective mechanisms. The question was, How come we don't get into trouble by supplementing euthyroid dogs and down the road getting into issues? And there's it's kind of got a two-part question. The first is related to how do they protect themselves. And when you give them thyroid supplement and they don't need it, they have increased excretion of thyroid hormone in the stool. It binds the proteins in the intestine. And they have increased binding in the bloodstream. So as long as it's bound in the bloodstream and not free, it's kind of, you know what I mean, it doesn't recognize that it's there. So there's protective mechanisms, increased metabolism, increased excretion, increased protein binding to protect. It's very hard to induce hyperthyroidism in a dog with thyroid supplement. It can be done, but staying within the realm of what we use for supplements, you know, it doesn't happen very often. And when it does happen for me, it's usually an animal that's really got an abnormal metabolism of the drug. And you can get, you know, they're really small amounts and they're still hyperthyroid. They just don't tolerate the drug at all. It's hanging around for a long time and creating some issues. The other issue has to do with, if you know, high numbers. And what do we want for our post-pill testing? And do we have to worry about chronic complications if they're on the medication? To me, when we do post-pill testing, I like to get a sample somewhere around 4 to 6 hours after they've administered. Again, I'm a BID treater. I treat them twice a day myself. And I try to get a sample 4 to 6 hours after they've had the medication. So when they're coming in for a recheck, you know, I always, you know, give them at 7, have them come in around 11, and we'll draw a blood sample. And to me, I want that, ideally I would like that post-pill to be somewhere between 1.5 and 3. That's where I really want it. I'll let it inkle up to 4, maybe 5, but above 5, I kind of back off on the dose. Less than 1, as a general knee-jerk reaction, you say, oh, I got to give more. But I'm measuring TSH as well as T4s now on my post-pill monitoring because that gives me an assessment of suppression. And while there's no low value in a TSH, the assay's not good enough, undetectable still in a normal range, if you've got a dog that comes in with a TSH that's, let's say, 1, at time of diagnosis, normal goes up to 0.6, you put them on supplement, what I want that TSH to drop down like 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, somewhere in there. You know, if I've got a dog that comes in and it's got a post-pill T4 of 1 and a TSH now that's become undetectable, you know, that would tend to suggest that we may be giving a little bit too much thyroid hormone. It may be a problem. The point I'm trying to make is that the value is not as important as the clinical signs of the dog. I was at, where was it? Oh, Barbados. I was in Barbados at our endocrine meeting in November, and Bob Franklin was in the audience, who's a board-certified internist in Portland, and he had asked me, well, you know, what happens if your post-pill test is less than 2.5? You give them more until you get that post-pill to be above 2.5, and because that's what the dermatologists at his practice were recommending. And I go, no. You know, in fact, the majority of my animals, really, they're between 1 and 2. Most of my animals are between 1 and 2 on a post-pill test, and they're doing great. Clinically, they're doing great. I would not increase my dose to try to meet some arbitrary value of 2.5. I just wouldn't do that. The most important thing when we do post-pill testing is how the animal looks. Is the owner happy? Does the dog look good on physical exam? Is it active? Have the clinical signs undergone resolution? You know, you're there. You're really there. And then the issue just becomes, if your TSH is undetectable, does that imply excessive suppression of the pituitary thyroid axis? And if you have excessive suppression, where can that lead you? And I think in a dog, it really doesn't lead us anywhere because they don't live long enough. In people, it leads to osteoporosis. In people, when they're overdosed on thyroid supplement for decades, they have a tendency to develop osteoporosis of the bone. So they're very, very careful and regimented in trying to keep those values within a certain area. But, you know, again, people, you're talking decades. Dogs, maybe 10 years or so. And we used to have some concerns about the heart, but that doesn't seem to play out much either. Okay? I kind of rambled a little bit there, but, yeah. So why I do the post-pill testing? To make myself feel better and make money. I think the primary reason that you're testing is you're looking for outliers. You're looking for that animal where the post-pill test is too high, like a 7 or an 8, and you got to back off. And I'm looking for an animal where the post-pill test is less than 1. You know, where it's coming in, it's like 0.4, 0.5, 0.6. And I want to make sure that I don't have antibodies. And if you get that kind of a number, then I'm a little bit more aggressive in talking to the client. You know, what are they really seeing? You know, are you really sure everything is okay? You're not seeing, you know, hyperactivity. The worst thing with hyperthyroidism in a dog is aggression. Aggressive behavior. I mean, that's the thing. That's the nightmare. Because every once in a while you'll get, you know, just like a hyperthyroid cat, they get aggressive and you treat them and they calm down. Well, that can happen in a dog as well. And all of a sudden you got a, you know, a dog that gets aggressive and bites family members. So you're always worried a little bit about that. But I'm looking for those outliers is what I'm really looking for. To say, okay, the dog may be doing well clinically, but I really think we probably need to make some fine-tuned adjustments here and see if we can't get those numbers a little bit more to what I would really like to see. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure I understand the question. You mean could you have an increased value because of increased protein binding?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things you can always fall back on is measuring free T4 and seeing what your free T4 is. I don't do, you know, some people will recommend it. That is the best test for pulse-pill testing. But again, you've got a machine in your hospital that can measure T4. Why not use the machine? And if I get into a situation where things get screwy, then I go to the next step. And the next step would be, okay, if they're on phenobarbital or if I've got a situation where maybe this total T4 is a misread, then I'll get a free T4 and see what my free T4 is. And if my free T4 is in a normal range, or is that also elevated? And so if you've got increased protein binding and your free T4 is normal, and the dog's doing okay, then I would be more inclined to say, okay, let's just sit tight. Whereas if the free T4 was elevated, if it's up over 3.5 to 4, then that would make me nervous, and I would tend to back off on that. That one I can't answer. What you're asking me is, if you've got a lot of T4 and it's binding to thyroglobulin or prealbumin, could you have an excess of another drug that binds to the same protein and displaces it? Is that what you're asking? Oh. I don't know. I can't answer that one. I don't know how specific. I mean, thyroid, you know, the primary binder is TBG, and I don't know how much TBG would bind, how much other things would bind to thyroid binding globulin. You know what I mean? Whether it's a specific. But it also binds to prealbumin and albumin, so in theory, those are minor players, but in theory, that could potentially happen. In theory. But I've never really read anything or heard of anybody who's actually ever looked at that. So I'm not sure. I didn't mean to get off on this tangent to the to the post-pill testing thing. Any other questions? Okay, let's go back to the... Where was I? Oh, yeah. Interpretation of test results. T4. I use T4 to identify normalcy, and I've said that for many, many, many years. It's a test of euthyroidism. A normal T4 rules out hypothyroidism. A low T4 means you have to step back and give it critical assessment. You have to step back and say, how low is it? The lower the better. I like to see them less than 0.5, quite frankly. What's the nature and severity of the clinical signs? Are they appropriate for hypothyroidism, or do I have concurrent problems in the animal? And what's the nature of the concurrent illnesses and the kinds of medications that the animal is on? And so to me, I use a sliding scale. And quite frankly, if I get a T4 that's greater than 1.5, that's a euthyroid animal. The only exception would be if you had antibodies that were binding the T4 and causing the value to be falsely elevated, an interference with the assay, and giving you a higher number. And if you have a normal T4 and you have strong indicators that it's hypothyroid, that's when a thyroid panel would be indicated, to get a free T4 and see whether or not, you know, you've got antibodies there, and to run a thyroglobulin autoantibody as a marker. Okay? But as a general rule of thumb, unless you've got antibodies, and they occur in less than 1% of hypothyroid animals, do we get antibodies that interfere with T4 and cause it to get up into the normal or elevated range? Not very common. Then down in this range, less than 1.5, the lower you go, the more comfortable I am making the diagnosis, assuming that the clinical signs and physical findings and other blood work, such as cholesterol and such, are also appropriate. A few words about the free T4. I've already mentioned it. It's a better test. The reason that I do it as part of the panel because that's what I routinely do when I'm checking thyroid. There's two ways to measure free T4. There's radioimmunoassays, and there are assays that use a dialysis technique. The dialysis technique is better. But in some of these commercial labs, you have to request the dialysis technique because the RIAs are cheaper. They're cheaper and they're quicker and they're easier to run. The dialysis technique is considerably more expensive. This was a study that we did, actually did it several different times, but we looked at three different groups of dogs and we took blood samples from these dogs and we compared five different radioimmunoassays that were out at the time and the Nichols kit, which is the modified dialysis, and the standard dialysis, which Duncan Ferguson ran down in Georgia, which is the gold standard, really technical type of an assay. And what we found was that the average free T4 values in the healthy dogs were 15 to 55% lower with the RIAs. So the numbers from the healthy dogs were significantly lower on the RIAs than the dialysis. There was no difference in the hypothyroids, but that's because they don't have any hormone. If your thyroid levels are low, if they're non-detectable, they're going to be non-detectable no matter what assay you use. So this isn't a problem here, but the biggest issue was here. We looked at a population of dogs with non-thyroidal illness that were euthyroid. We were doing TSH stim tests to separate these animals out at the time, initially. And the average free T4 was significantly lower in the dogs where we checked the free T4 assay and where we did RIAs for the free T4 compared to the healthy dogs and was the equilibrium dialysis. If you compared healthy dogs, euthyroid healthy, and sick euthyroid, and you looked at the results of the radioimmunoassays, the free T4 and the sick euthyroids were significantly lower than the healthy. If you looked at the dialysis technique, healthy euthyroid, sick euthyroid, there was no significant difference in the results. What that means is that the dialysis technique is less affected by concurrent illness. The RIAs are more affected by concurrent illness, and there's a greater tendency to have suppressed results that give you a false sense of a positive hit for the disease. And this is just a study that Mark Peterson put out that I like to show because it's a really nice illustration comparing free T4 and T4. Number one, these are box plots. The box represents the inner 50%. The bar represents the median. The whiskers represent the range with some outliers. Mild, moderate, severe disease in euthyroid animals. The values drop. The more severe the illness, the more the T4 is suppressed. More than 50% of the results over here are below normal with severe illness. If we look at that, so that's that concept I talked about. One of the parameters you look at is the severity of the illness. The more severe the illness, the more likely to drop. If we look at the free T4 and we compare the boxes and where they're located and the median, they're higher than the T4. It's less affected. The majority of the results on the sick are in the normal range. That's why the free T4 with the dialysis technique is a better test. The problem is just expense and sending it out. Can you do it as your front line? Sure. I do it as my front line, along with a T4 and a TSH. Okay, we've got the same sliding scale, though. You can drive the free T4 to zero with a severe illness. And so you always interpret it. You have to always look at all those parameters. And again, it's a sliding scale of probability. The farther down I am, the closer I am to non-detectable, the more I'm thinking maybe I have it, unless I've got severe systemic illness present in that animal. Okay, TSH. The theory behind TSH, we always thought, we've been trying. I actually started working on it when I was at Purdue in the 80s trying to develop a TSH assay. I used to harvest pituitary glands out of animals that were euthanized, you know, because we were trying to collect TSH and then do sequencing of the molecule and try to develop an assay against it. I got real good at taking pituitaries out of dogs. So we were doing a lot of work because we realized back in the 80s that the assays used in humans didn't work in dogs. TSH assay is very species specific. That's why it took so long to get a dog assay. And we were hopeful that the dog assay would help us, because the theory behind it is that as your thyroid gland is destroyed, your T4 goes down, you lose suppression on the pituitary, and your TSH goes up. So, you know, in theory, T4 is going to be low, free T4 is going to be low, TSH is going to be high. That's what we were hoping, that this piece of the puzzle would help us. Unfortunately, it really hasn't helped us a whole heck of a lot. First of all, the normal range extends down to zero, undetectable. That's normal. You can't say you have a low TSH. There is no low TSH because the assay can't identify that. You can't hit a lower end of normal with the assay that's currently available, which means we can't really identify pituitary suppression. Now, I just talked about post-pill testing and looking at a TSH, and to me, if you get an undetectable TSH, well, you know, maybe that's a little bit too much, and maybe we ought to back off a little bit and try to drive that TSH back up into that 0.2, 0.4 range. The real problem is TSH can be normal with hypothyroidism about 20% of the time. There was a nice study out of Czechoslovakia, of all places, where they actually did pathology. They got biopsies of the thyroid in these dogs and histologically confirmed the presence of hypothyroidism and normal TSHs. And TSH can be increased with concurrent illness and medication. It just depends on what influence that illness or drug has on the pituitary. If it suppresses pituitary function, the TSH will not go up. But if it doesn't affect pituitary function, like phenobarbital, the pituitary will respond to the suppressive effects of that drug or that illness as it drops the T4 and the free T4. As those go down, the TSH is going to go up in response to that. The highest TSH values that I've ever seen have been in non-thyroidal illness. I've had a few that have gotten up over 2 to 3 nanograms per mil. That's really high. They've not been in hypothyroid dogs. They've been in these illness issues. And unfortunately, unlike T4, there's no rhyme or reason to the severity of the illness. Again, this is coming back to Mark's study. Mild, moderate, severe illness, TSH over here, and you got these high values. These are outliers that are high, independent of the severity of the illness. There's no rhyme or reason. It depends more on the nature of the illness and its impact on the pituitary than on severity of illness as a blanket statement. So, how do we interpret TSH? It's a nice thing to add. That's the way I look at it. I don't make a call one way or the other with the TSH. You know, we can't use it as the sole test. It never, ever use it as the sole test because you have false positives and false negatives. It always is interpreted in conjunction with a T4 and or free T4, number one. An increased TSH supports hypothyroidism. A normal TSH doesn't rule it out. You got false positives and false negatives. It's one of those things that if the TSH is what I would like it to be, I feel more comfortable in saying I have the disease. But if I've got an animal that's screaming hypothyroid and my T4 and free T4 are low and my TSH is normal, I ignore it. Because the free T4 and the T4 are driving my bus in terms of diagnostics more than the TSH. And so it's just one of those things that, okay, if it goes the way I'd like it to go, I feel more comfortable. If it doesn't go the way I want it to go, I kind of don't look at it all that much. You could say, well, why even measure it? No? You can just as well not measure it. You know, the T4 and the free T4 are really the true markers of thyroid function. Thyroid hormone antibodies. Thyroid hormone antibodies are markers of lymphocytic thyroiditis, which is down here in illustration. Lymphocytic plasmacytic infiltration of the thyroid gland. Okay? Markers of lymphocytic thyroiditis. It's a pathology test. It's a pathology test. That's all it is. It has nothing to do with thyroid function. It can alter thyroid hormone test results. On a T4, it has a tendency to cause the numbers to go up with most of the RIAs that are out there. It's been used to identify breed predispositions and give us a clue for genetic susceptibility. Remember, only 50% of dogs with hypothyroidism have a positive thyroid antibody test. A negative antibody test doesn't rule out hypothyroidism. Half the dogs that we see, the test is negative. They have idiopathic atrophy. They have no thyroid gland left. There are no antibodies there. But in the ones that do have antibodies, that's a pretty strong marker for lymphocytic thyroiditis. And we can use that marker as a breed evaluation to say this breed has problems with lymphocytic thyroiditis and this breed doesn't. And Nachreiner's published a couple of papers. And the beauty of Michigan State is in this arena because they see thousands of animals. And they published a study a few years ago. I think there was more than 10,000 animals in that study, looking at the prevalence of antibody positivity based on breeds. And they came out with a list of about 20 breeds that were high and 20 breeds that were real low in terms of probability. And the real high ones support genetics and the real low ones don't. Okay, it's also used as an early screening test in this OFA thyroid registry. How many people here have heard of that, an OFA registry? Are you using it? Do you use it at all? We do it. We've been doing it from the get-go. It was developed back in 96, 97. The idea of the thyroid registry is to try to identify important dogs that could have an impact on their breed or lineage that may be carriers of hypothyroidism or will develop hypothyroidism and don't breed them. That's the idea behind it. And you use the antibody test as your marker. We know that in the development of lymphocytic thyroiditis and clinical hypothyroidism, the dogs go antibody positive first, and then over the ensuing 2 to 4 years, as you get slow destruction of the thyroid, you'll get a drop in your thyroid levels, and near the end of that, they start to develop clinical signs. It's a very slow process. It doesn't happen quick. And so the theory behind this registry thing is you take the dogs when they're 1 year of age, and you measure antibody test at one, and you measure it every year thereafter. And if you get a positive hit, then that would suggest that they may have lymphocytic thyroiditis, and you may not want to breed that dog. It's a nice theory, but it doesn't really work. In my experience, when I have dealt with very valuable breeding animals, I had one that came in second at Westminster, had lymphocytic thyroiditis, hypothyroidism, been to somebody in New York, been to somebody in Florida. You know, those dogs all have multiple owners. And then it came out and saw me. And every time you could map it, the T4, free T4 were lower, the TSH was higher, the antibody was positive. By the time it got to me, the free T4 and T4 were zero, the TSH was like 2. You know, I'm going, well, you got hypothyroidism here, you probably shouldn't breed this dog. And the guy just took the dog and said, it's not much of a disease anyway. I'm going to just go ahead and do what I want. I thought, well, okay, there you go. You know, So I don't think that the registry personally is going to make a big impact. What it does do, though, this registry, what it has done is opened up Pandora's box for another issue. And that is, if you run thyroid panels and you include an antibody test, and thyroglobulin is the preferred antibody, what happens when you get a positive thyroglobulin autoantibody test and everything else is normal? Your T4, free T4, and TSH are normal. How do you interpret that? What do you do with that information? And we don't know. Does that mean the dog is going to go hypothyroid? Maybe yes, maybe no. The reality is, we just don't know. Lymphocytic thyroiditis, progressive permanent lymphocytic thyroiditis, may or may not be present. Hypothyroidism may or may not develop. All you can do is follow it. And so, in a one-year, the only thing that's out there is a one-year prospective study that never was published by Peter Graham, who's over in the UK now. He was at Michigan when he did this. And basically, they followed these dogs, this type of dog, for a year. 20% progressed, meaning the T4 and free T4 had fallen and the TSH was climbing. About 15% reverted to a negative, and about 65% was exactly the same. Hadn't changed at all. Everything was exactly as it was. And so when I get a client that says, I got a dog that's got a positive antibody, what do? This is what I tell them. I kind of make the numbers easier. I say, well, you got 20% chance in a year it's going to progress. 20% it will no longer be positive and you'll have a normal dog. And 60% there won't be any change and all you can do is follow. And that's very frustrating for breeders. One last, I'll kind of tie it all together here, establishing the diagnosis. I keep coming back or mentioning history and physical because that's the most important thing when you're talking about hypothyroidism. Is the history and the physical exam, are they appropriate for the disease? The primary players are metabolism, attitude, activity, tendency to gain weight, all those kinds of areas, cellular metabolism, skin, and neuromuscular. Those are the main players. Okay, weakness and such in the neuromuscular system and the alopecias, pyoderma, seborrhea in the skin. Those are the three things that we look at predominantly. Hyperlipidemia, greater than 75 to 80% of the cases that we see have hypercholesterolemia. That's what I'm looking for. And the cholesterol and the triglycerides can get really high, over 1,000. Tremendous elevations in these lipids. And then a low T4, a low free T4, a high TSH, and a positive antibody. That's a piece of cake. That is rare in my world, to have all those things fall like that. Usually, it's a hodgepodge, where any individual test would tend to lead you one way and another test the other. That's usually what we're dealing with, and that's why it gets confusing. And so you have to ask yourself, when you're doing these tests, which one is the one that you're going to rely on? And to me, it's a no-brainer. Multiple studies have shown that the free T4 with a dialysis technique is much better than any of the others. You can run a T4 as a screen. If it's normal, forget it. If it's low and the signs are strongly suggestive, treat them. But if it's low and you're not really sure, then you move into a free T4. And when I run all these things in my panel, what drives the bus for me is the free T4. If I'm not sure what way to go, I'm staring at that free T4 and saying, well, where is that in relationship to high and low? And that's what I use to ultimately decide, do I try to treat or not? TSH is kind of a moot point. Most of the articles that are being published right now are TSH stim-related articles out of Europe because they don't have a free T4 assay over there. So they're using human recombinant TSH, and we've looked into it. And unfortunately, human recombinant TSH right now, a vial, which will maybe at most run 10 dogs, the last time I looked at it was around $1,000, and you had to buy two. So you had to buy two vials. And then you'd have to aliquot it out and freeze it, and it's like, forget it. So the TSH, you'll see a lot about TSH stim tests if you're into the research literature at all on the thyroid and the dog. Most of it's coming from Sylvia Damene, a real sweet lady from Belgium. But again, they're trying to develop the TSH stim test over there because they don't have the free T4. Any questions? I've got 1 minute. Yeah.
I have a cat question.
Okay, good. The question was, if you've got a T4, basically what you're asking is occult hyperthyroidism, or the early stages of a hyperthyroid cat where your T4 is in the upper half of the normal range, but it's not diagnostic. Presumably you can feel a thyroid nodule. Maybe you got the right signs, maybe you don't. You're early on. And the recommendation is to do a free T4. And that, in fact, is the current in vogue recommendation to run a free T4. The reason is that the free T4 will be a more accurate assessment in a hyperthyroid cat than the T4, because there was a nice study that Mark did. He looked at about 970 cats, but let's make it easy and say 1,000 cats, and the scenario you're describing, the occult hyperthyroidism occurred in 10% based on T4, and when he looked at free T4 with dialysis, it dropped to less than 2%. So you cut down on the prevalence of the occult cats. The problem with free T4 is that in a very, very small percentage, less than 1% of cats, but it still is there, with non-thyroidal illness, the free T4 can be high. It can be above the normal range. And they're not hyperthyroid. For that reason, you never do a free T4 by itself in a cat. You always interpret free T4 in relationship to T4. If your T4 is in the upper half of the normal range and your free T4 is high, you got it. Odds are you got it. If your free T4 is in the lower half and you got a high free T4, you don't. But the reality is, if you only measure free T4s based on a T4, if you're in the lower half, you're not going to measure it anyway. So it's always going to be in the upper half. But you always want a free T4 and a T4 on the same blood sample. So what you can do is take the sample, get enough serum, send it into the lab, see what the T4 is. If it's in that non-diagnostic range, then you ask them to go ahead and tag in a free T4 on top of that. And that's the problem. You can't use free T4 by itself because you'll get false positives. Any other questions? Yeah. Yep. Actually, I would just do a panel. If you're going to go to the route of a free T4, you might as well just do the panel. Which again, to me, would be the T4, the free T4, the TSH, and an antibody. Now, if they've got other stuff tagged in for the same price, the T3, okay, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to look at it anyway. But that would be the next step. Interestingly enough, obesity actually has a tendency, and I probably shouldn't tell you this because you're all going to go off running away with this probably, but obesity is one of those scenarios where a T4s actually increase, not decrease. And the increase is not clinically relevant. But the reason that T4 goes up with obesity is the amount of calories coming in. It's not the obesity, it's the caloric intake and the demand to handle that caloric intake. And so your thyroid levels have a tendency to inkle up a little bit rather than inkle down. Obesity doesn't cause your thyroid to go down. It actually causes it to go up based on caloric intake. Yeah. I would take a free T4 over a TSH any day of the week. If money's not a factor, then I would add it all in and just try to get a true read. What kind of cancer? The question was, you got test results that are kind of wishy-washy, low thyroid levels, and some of those dogs have turned out to have cancer. In other words, they got non-thyroidal illness. And so are you better off trying to do a more complete screen? That's kind of an individual decision in my mind. What I would do, I can't say, yeah, absolutely, you ought to do it, abdominal ultrasound, chest rads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because that, I think, is overkill in most cases. You have to ask yourself why you ran the thyroid panels to begin with, and what are my clinical signs? And if I have clinical manifestations that are not strongly suggestive of hypothyroid and could be related to something else, then I'll do additional diagnostics. But I would not just arbitrarily, do all these tests just because my T4 is in a nebulous range or my T4, free T4 is in a nebulous range, per se. I keep coming back to the history and physical. That's critical. Yeah. One more. Yeah. Yeah. Their ranges are just taken out of textbooks. And my guess is they probably took it out of our endocrine book. And I used to believe that. I think in the last edition, I might even say, ideally we want it to be between 2.5 and 5. But it's just, I modify all the time. I'm rewriting, the endocrine section of the Nelson Cotto book, and I'm modifying it all the time. As you get more and more and more experience, you start saying, I'm seeing a lot of dogs where the post-pill is 1.5 to 2, 2.5, and they're doing just fine. So the next edition of the next big thing that I put out on endocrine is going to be modified. And odds are they'll modify that. The one that kills me the most is Plum. Plum will have stuff in there. And I'll say, where'd they get that? And they'll open it up. Well, right here, it says it's from, Feldman and Nelson or Nelson and Cotto. I was like, I didn't write that. But they take things, they're just taking them and plopping them. Yeah. The only time, the question was a trough versus peak. Again, it has to do with timing and the nature of the clients and how far they come for us. And so most of the time, we've got a one-shot deal. If they're really close and you're in the trough and peak, that gives you more information. If they're on once a day, then you got to get a trough and a peak because you really need to see how low they're going. But again, it's how the animal looks and what the owner sees that drives that bus more than anything. So the question was, what would you do if you had a low, really low free T4 and a borderline T4 in terms of monitoring therapy? Exactly what I'd say. I wouldn't change anything. I'd still rely on T4 and the clinical signs and such. And only if things seemed to get a little bit weird would I then say, okay, we need to do more. Okay, we got diabetes in an hour.